Hello, it's Wednesday, it's Women's Day, and that means it's time for an edition of the HTXT Africast. Yeah, can you believe it? We're actually doing this on a public holiday. No, it's not a public, we record this on Tuesday, so it's very much a working day, and we figured that we'd try and make this like a roundup slash relaxed edition of the HTXT Africast this week.
If you have nothing going on your public holiday, just this is all the bad news you missed. Nothing bad is happening today, though, because it's Women's Day.
Well, let's not say that, because I mean we can't foretell the future.
Let's hope that nothing bad happens.
In studio today is myself, Brendan Lotz. Joining me is Nick Cowan.
Hello.
And we have a special guest this week. It is Jeff Burrows.
Hello.
Jeff, who are you?
I am a game developer and 3D artist, and I am, working my way through the South African game development industry.
Okay,
what cool. Jeff isn't telling you, though, is he's also the reigning champion of the preview event for Evolve.
That's true.
That was an international event. This is where Jeff and I met, actually. It was an international event where we were looking at 2K games,
mm-hmm.
and Evolve was there, and Jeff won. The whole damn thing.
I beat the developers at their own game.
He beat the developers with their monster.
Yeah.
That's quite a claim to fame. Mm.
Yeah, that's really the best I've ever achieved. Yeah.
I tell you what, the thing is, Evolve didn't do very well after it came out, but I swear to God, the vibe in that room was literally, all the journalists were like crowded around Jeff like kids at an arcade machine.
it was mad. I mean, they were cheering me on and screaming and shouting, and I'm sure there was crying and wailing and women fainting in the background, and at least the way I remember it.
That's all that matters.
There's probably crying and wailing right now because, as we say this, there's a no confidence vote.
Yes, there is.
Is it the 8th now? I think it's the 8th.
Probably. I don't really do days.
I remember what.
Yes, it is the 8th today when we record this.
So, that no matter what, he makes history. No one in this country's had 8 consecutive no confidence votes in Parliament. No one.
Yeah.
Well, so that's a record. You're a record holder? He's a record holder. Zoom is a record holder.
Yeah, I'm not a record holder. I have no records except for maybe longest hours slept in a day.
Longest hours
still
spent
impressive.
On Dota?
No, not even close.
Longest hours spent on Dota at HTXT.
Yes, there we go. That's my claim to fame. As we speak, the no confidence vote is going on. But I don't suspect that we will know whether Jacob Zuma has been voted out or not until much later today, because there is all the MPs basically have an opportunity to stand up and speak. So we could be here until tomorrow morning when we release this.
Oh, well, there you go.
I'm waiting for that. But one of the interesting things about this vote of no confidence is that if Jacob Zuma is ruled to be unfit to be president or voted out, the Speaker of the House, Baleka Mbete, becomes the president of the country. The entire cabinet gets dissolved as it stands.
Yeah.
We would essentially have no leadership until
business as usual.
Thursday.
Really, nothing would have changed at that stage. Yeah.
Until Thursday, I would think, because I don't foresee Parliament working tomorrow.
It's a holiday. Expect us to run the country.
So it's quite good. At the moment, from just looking at my Twitter feed, it looks like Julius Malema is speaking, which means we'll be here forever. It was actually quite a shock to me that Mbete decided to make the vote secret.
Yeah.
I was pretty much counting on the fact that it wasn't going to be secret.
Here's a question for the pair of you. Do you think the no confidence vote's going to go through?
I'm not confident. just historically, we know how these things go. For me, it's not a matter of whether it happens or not. It's the discussions that happen around it.
Yeah.
And people waking up to realize what's going on.
Mm.
And even if that build-up happens in like the tiniest way, it's still a move forwards.
Do you think it's going to go through?
Because
Clinton's one of our staff writers. He was convinced it was going to go through.
I don't know what to think anymore. I mean, if you asked me yesterday before the secret ballots decision was announced, I would have straight up said to you, no, it's not gonna go through.
You're not sure.
And now I'm not sure, because I mean, like, there's a lot wrong in this country at the moment. I don't think we have to dive into the specifics about it, but the corruption is rife, We have a president that has time and time again proved that he is above the law. And I think that's hopefully the ANC MPs today kind of look at this and go, well, what's the best thing we can do for the country and not for the ANC?
See, there's been a couple of pieces I've seen about this. Like, well, there was one, I think, in Times Live that they said, like, I think it was Times Live, it could have been the Mail and Guardian, but somebody said, if the vote goes through and he is basically voted down, voted out, let's say, that's a real blow for democracy because, you know, secret ballots should be confined to the public. It's no one's business what you and I, who you and I vote for, but it is our business who our MPs vote for. It really is, and how they vote, because they're elected officials who are beholden unto the electorate, even though in practice, not a lot, but like that's in theory. But
yeah,
my thoughts on this is it's not going to go through. I think the no confidence vote won't go through. And the reason I think that is because Betty made it a secret ballot.
Yeah.
A lot of commentators, not myself and not anyone else at HTXT, are you listening, ANC lawyers, have said that she's pretty much in the Zuma camp. That's what they've said. And to my mind, if that is true, I think that the Zuma camp would have its ducks in a row before one of them goes, yeah, sure, I have the secret ballot.
Yeah, so, I mean, we'll see what happens later this afternoon. You might be listening to this and laughing at us on Wednesday morning.
Well, I think people just listen to us and laugh at us anyway.
So, yeah, that's the no confidence vote that is happening as we speak.
Yeah.
And we will know the outcome of tomorrow.
Yeah. In other news, you had someone get fired at Google. You haven't heard about this.
I haven't, no.
Okay, so long story short, at the weekend, a software engineer at Google wrote an internal memo which went viral through the company and eventually got leaked to Gizmodo because people were so pissed off with it, where he basically intimated that there are certain differences between men and women which make men's aptitude towards technology more than women, and we all live in this left-wing echo chamber, and perhaps we shouldn't be doing that.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think of that as a software developer?
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, I mean,
tread carefully here, Jeff. This guy got fired for that.
Yeah, like, I mean, Google positions themselves as this, like, progressive, I don't know, liberal, but at least progressive company.
Mm.
And
they've been under the cosh recently as well, because wasn't there a lawsuit filed about discrepancy in pay between male and female employees?
Actually,
there?
I remember that a little while ago, yeah. Yeah, so, you know, I mean, I don't know, maybe it's just telling of the true character. You know, I mean, I can't imagine that.
I don't know if it's true character, but it certainly says something about received wisdom in Silicon Valley, because I don't think this is the only guy who feels as well.
Yeah, exactly right. So if one guy decides to send out that memo and he needs to voice his concerns or whatever they were, then, like, I mean, he's not doing that in isolation.
No.
You know, like, I mean, it's...
Yeah, he's obviously, like, spoken to his mates and been like, oh, no, no, and somebody said
let's
to
take
him,
this,
yes.
Let's take this drunken bar conversation into the internal system.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, I mean, that's probably just the tip of the iceberg, I can imagine. So, I mean, I hope Google will do something more than just sack the guy. Like, you know, do some investigation into that. Find out what's going on. Like, you can't have mentalities like that. Like, like, either running rife or kind of just
bubbling under.
I mean, they're both dangerous. Mm. You know, it's
there was a really good piece written on Medium about this where someone said, like, okay, here's why he should have been sacked. And it's like, okay, let's just leave aside his report, okay, with its errors and its stereotypes and the large chunk he took from Wikipedia, which is always a great source stick in in a document of this type. He said, like, once you make that public, if I'm your line manager, how do I assign you to a department that has any women in it?
Mm.
If you become a line manager, how can anyone trust that you're going to give female employees a fair shake?
Yeah.
You know, if these ideas and these, you know, opinions of yours are strong enough within you to warrant a memo like this, you are essentially spreading disharmony at this company, which is the sackable offense.
Yeah.
It is. Like, that's essentially the upshot of it. I mean, I also agree, like, I've seen a lot of I think, are very dispiriting is that, like, a lot of people on the left are crowing and laughing and saying, good, I'm glad he was sacked, because I think that anyone who stands there and claims the moral high ground while jeering somebody who's having to clear out their desk, like, you should probably take a good long look in the mirror, really.
Yeah.
But I just read that and was like, I think you can measure the time it's going to take this guy to get fired on an egg timer, really. And I don't see any issue with that.
Yeah, look, I think if you're going to work for Google and you're going to take some the unpopular opinion and throw it around, like...
You can have unpopular opinions.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I don't like Rick and Morty, and that's a very, very unpopular opinion. What?
Get out!
I'm sorry, I have to leave. I'm going to go get shrifty.
But I do think that if you're going to work for Google and you're going to have an opinion that is very much something in the public realm, where it's like, it is not okay to be a chauvinistic male that believes men are the greatest sex of all time.
Oh no, but the thing about these people is like, oh, they don't believe that. They said there are certain things that men can just do better than women. And it's like,
well, I would like to know what that is.
Better than men, for example. That's the attitude that comes
out. Well, that's
out.
One example, and that is probably the only thing that sets us apart.
I'd say there's more than that, but I would say that the idea that, like, you know.
Okay, in the context of Google, then, right? I mean, what is it that
any company really? I mean, you know, it's like, you know, you can't ascribe aptitude.
Yeah, absolutely not
to your gender.
No,
I mean, that's ridiculous.
That's pathetic.
Anyway, so that was the other story, and then finally, of course, you have HBO. Oh, we've run out of time for the news.
Well, we can talk about HBO very quickly.
HBO got. Here's the other story you're not aware of. HBO got hacked a couple of weeks ago, and while they didn't come forward and say, okay, this is what data is missing, the hackers in question, the alleged hackers, said that they had 1.5 terabytes of data from HBO.
My question is, how do you get away with that much data and nobody knows?
Well, that's,
how do you not notice 1.5 terabytes of data just slowly being siphoned off?
Especially when it includes things like episodes of entire seasons of Ballers and entire seasons of Room 107.
Yeah.
Sorry, Room 104. And what was the other thing? Scripts for the upcoming Game of Thrones episodes.
I mean, that's your own carelessness at the end of the day.
Okay, but here's the thing, right? And this is what I wanted to talk about. Was, okay, so the hackers today basically came back and they issued a demand. An email was sent to Wired by HBO. The figure for what they're asking for is redacted, so we don't know exactly how much. But basically, they're threatening to release spoilers and full episodes. Wow. You know, it's like, pay us this amount of money or we're going to ruin Game of Thrones for everybody. And it's like, this is not the first attack like this has happened. Like, Netflix got ganked like this back in, I think it was March?
April.
April. And the hackers got hold of the new season of Orange is the New Black. I'm just wondering, Kate, just... leaving aside the amorality of helping yourself to other people's data through nefarious means, what does it say about us that pay me or I'll spoil your show?
I'm very sensitive to Game of Thrones spoilers, especially to the point where, like, I feel more of a compulsion to watch the show to avoid the spoilers than to actually watch the show.
Wow.
Yeah. Like Twitter is a dangerous place for me when it comes to Game of Thrones. I'll watch it. I'm up to date. Cool. Nothing can be spoiled. But I mean, if someone releases all that stuff publicly, I'm not going to go looking for it, you know, and I'll just switch off any mentions of Game of Thrones.
Well, this is the thing that, like, when the Orange is the New Black hack happened, I mean, it was online for everybody to watch, but, like, so one of my friends, is actually a friend, went and found a copy and downloaded it and was like, this is terrible. Yeah. The quality is horrible. I'm just going to wait for this to get onto Netflix. I can watch it at full HD.
Yeah.
And the hackers kind of got foiled in that way, and that their copy was worse than what you could get if you streamed it on Netflix.
Yes.
Or waited for it to be released and then let somebody download a full HD copy or whatever. It's just kind of like, I don't think people are that keen to know what happens next, that they'll go and download something or go and actively seek out spoilers.
See, the thing is, I'm not like either of you really then in that case, because I can care less about spoilers. If somebody comes on my Twitter feed and goes, oh, you know, this happens, let's say, like, you know, I mean, this doesn't happen, but let's say Jaime Lannister gets killed in the next episode.
Yeah.
I don't know if that happens.
I really don't know.
Okay.
So.
But, like, if I saw that, Jaime Lannister's dead, I'd be like, who cares? I'm sure there's more going on in the episode than just this.
Yeah.
And also, you know, dick. Just block you. I mean, but I don't understand people who literally lose their minds or become incredibly angry just because they have one dick in their timeline who spoiled things for them. It's like, it's a TV show.
Yeah.
Just gain some perspective.
Yeah,
it's not like it's a video game.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was that similar incident with CD Projekt Red, where Cyberpunk 2077 was sort of half leaked or whatever it was, and then held for ransom, and CD Projekt Red basically said, like, get screwed.
Yeah.
You know, if someone wants to download this broken ass version of the game, then
go for it.
Like,
you're gonna get half the experience.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so it's.
And the audience for that game will really wait. They will wait.
Yeah.
They will wait.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I know, because I'm one of them. I wouldn't. First of all, downloading a half-assed version of a game is stupid.
Yeah.
I mean,
you are ruining it for yourself.
Exactly.
You're not getting a head start or anything.
It's not like you're going to play it and go, oh, well, that was time well spent and bandwidth well used.
And then you jump online and slam it, and everybody's like, but this game isn't even out yet. You're a pirate.
I hope
to jail.
Well, I hope that CD Projekt Red do what like some developers have done. Like the one that springs to mind is Rocksteady Games, where they basically leaked a version online of Batman Arkham Asylum, where they... essentially, if you had torrented this game, there's a section where you need to glide through a room full of poison gas.
Oh, yeah, and you stop halfway.
Yeah, and you stop halfway. and people came online going, this game's broken, man.
Maybe you should download the copy version.
Maybe you should pay for it then rather than steal from it.
I feel compelled to do that with my own game now.
which segues us very nicely.
Yes, wow. It's almost like you've been on this podcast before.
It's almost like you've been on a gaming podcast. So, Jeff, tell us about your game.
Yeah, my game is called Among the Innocent, A Stricken Tale. Mm-hmm. I released it in Feb on Steam.
Yeah.
It's a first-person adventure thriller game that takes place on an abandoned farm in the Eastern Free State.
Right.
And you play as this guy, Peter York. You find yourself kind of trapped on the farm. There's all these spooky, weird sorts of things going on. And it's up to you to sort of get to the bottom of it and find out how that existing narrative affects your current narrative.
Okay.
And... the two kind of...
So why the Eastern Free State?
Yeah, okay, so people ask me that quite often. It's one of my favorite places in this country.
Okay.
For two reasons. It is beautiful. It's magnificent there. Mm. You can go any time of the year and see something unique and beautiful. And there are dinosaur footprints and caveman paintings and fantastic landscapes and scenery. But also this really kind of like weird... sometimes old school conservative kind of creepiness about it, you know, like you go into a place like Clarence or Fariesburg and you see glimpses of like the epitome of old school South Africa, and it's disturbing. And
give us an example. Because I've been to Clarence once, and the only thing I remember from there was the hippie on the hill.
Yeah, I mean, you get those, you know, there are plenty of those. It's, you know, I mean, there's
vestiges of like apartheid era that are still in those towns. I mean, I know because I was actually born in Welkom and grew up there for most of my life. But like I've also driven to Cape Town quite a few times, and along that route you get to like these little towns where it's like there's still one or two people that are holding on to apartheid or something that happened in the past. Like the Geen Blankes or Slacks Blankes signs and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I get what you mean totally. I mean, it's like this little town where it's like there's something that's just not right here.
It's weird, right? And
it's
the same sort of stuff that I appreciate about East Asian horror films.
Hmm.
And like, although it's not the same topic, it's that same kind of unease that just kind of oozes throughout the whole place.
Hmm.
And... while my game doesn't focus on too much historical South African stuff, there are kind of glimpses of it, but that's more just kind of like backdrop stuff.
Yeah.
But that got me thinking about creating something sort of truly eerie and, you know, sort of physically a physically manifested version of that essence, of that creepy essence, but not specifically the topics themselves.
Do you think it's more like, I mean, because creepy implies, like, for me, it's like Silent Hill, and it's like where the inside of Silent Hill looks like the old Nine Inch Nails videos from back in 1992. But I mean, I've been to Clarence, like you, and like you said, there is a different vibe there. It's almost like, you know, pick your destination carefully, because you might walk into a bar or a hotel or some or a shop there, and that doorway is not a doorway into the building. It is a time warp that will take you back to 1955.
Yeah, it really is.
And to a degree, is that like where the Stricken Tale comes from? It's like you pitch up in this place, you open this door, and you've now entered the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some actual Twilight Zone influences there. Mm. And yeah, I like the idea of kind of taking an environment or a concept from my head, putting that in front of the players and asking them to explore that, you know. So it's very much like putting myself out there. Mm. And just, you know, as a like white South African, I have a specific perspective of South Africa.
Especially from a certain age.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
You know, I mean, this is one of the things I keep thinking about. It's like, I don't think that there's any, you know, I mean, not to say like poor little me or anything, but it's like the perspective you have after you've grown up in this country, seen the back end of apartheid, seen what's come after it, up to the here and now. It's like, you know, if you're in a position in London where you can get like cheap fiber broadband and you know, attend your football games, you don't know what the hell's going on down here. Although everyone thinks they do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I mean, for the most part, I probably don't understand a lot of the kind of real, like, personal stories. Mm. But I have my own personal story. Mm. And, it's kind of nice to take that personal story and that history and that connection that I have to this country and twist it up and make it, you know, sort of spooky and creepy and, you know, add in some supernatural elements or whatever it is. Mm. And kind of just sort of run with it. It's, you know, like, I like to imagine things. Like, I like to think about things that exist in the world and kind of twist them up a little bit. Mm.
Do you think that maybe our South African history sort of, and I need to be very careful about how I phrase this now, but do you think that game developers locally are afraid of broaching the topic of South Africa's past? And I'm talking particularly here about like white developers, white guys, that are a bit too hesitant to broach what happened during apartheid. And they kind of hold themselves back and look at, like, for instance, and I don't want to call them out for it, but the guys who did Broforce, which is very much entrenched in the whole Hollywood American superhero archetype. Mm. Whereas right here, I mean, we could have done something a little bit more South African, maybe. I don't know. Do you think that's kind of like our history presents a bit of a stumbling block for people?
I think it might. Mm. I kind of went into the game with some kind of boundaries for myself. I didn't want to make it this politically charged kind of game. You know, that's not what I'm setting out to do. I have a fantasy story that I want to tell. But, you know, I think if you're a developer in a country as unique and interesting as South Africa, you're almost doing yourself a disservice by not embracing that.
Yeah.
You know, what South Africa has made me is a South African game developer. Mm. And even if I were to leave the country, I would still bring that with me. You know, I mean, those are my roots. That's my history. That's who I am.
Yeah.
So it would almost be disingenuous for me to kind of just throw that aside and not put in elements of that. You know?
Yeah.
Mm. Even if it's not the setting, you know, it's, you know, we have an interesting perspective of the world down from the bottom end of South Africa. And I think it's fun to kind of embrace that and play with that. And, you know, if you make mistakes, if you offend people, if you do whatever, then that's cool. That's part of it. That's part of being a South African is...
And learning.
Yeah, learning, absolutely. You know, and, you know, like coming to terms with like how my perspective fits in this country's context. Mm.
Well, I mean, the thing is also about your game is that you pick your setting, but also yours is a narrative-driven game. It's a pretty dark game.
Yeah.
So I'm imagining you were in a pretty dark place when you started work on it.
I really was, yeah. I mean, the whole series of The Stricken Tale is themed around the five stages of dealing with grief.
Oh,
so this is the first of five games. The rest of the games are broadly written. Game two is kind of half written.
Yeah.
And game one is denial. And that was kind of fueled by when NAG magazine was shut down, I was editor of the magazine at the time, and I was retrenched. And I was like, you know, pretty bleak about it. You know, I mean, here's a magazine that I grew up reading, like from my teenage years. It was really like a formative part.
Sorry, just to interject, I was really sad that, like you say, it was a it was a magazine that I grew up with.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean,
it is where I got my drivers from.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, you know, so when the magazine was closed, I was I was bleak about it. And I remember driving home after the meeting I had with Michael and Lauren, in which I accepted my retrenchment. And I had this idea for a game in mind for a little while, but I didn't really have like the kind of hook for it. I didn't have the kind of the real meat of it in mind. And as I was driving home from that meeting, I suddenly kind of, everything sort of clicked together. And I was like, I actually need to just tell this story that is a bit about myself, but, you know, is something that anyone can relate to. And, you know, so the first game is Denial for that reason. And there are a lot of elements in the game that kind of play on that, you know. Admittedly, I kind of maybe didn't quite nail some of the delivery of those elements, and that's still something I intend to work on. I was maybe a little too obscure about some things here and there, but
that's good in a way, though, because that's the sort of stuff that inspires cults.
Yeah.
So the idea that it's like, okay, well, what did the developer mean here?
Yeah.
When did he do this?
Yeah.
And it's like, after a while, the cult becomes the... It doesn't matter.
Scott Cawthorne. Yeah.
It doesn't matter what the developer wanted. It's kind of like, it's what I think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there is nothing in that game...
No one sends you an email saying, I want you to change the ending of this game.
No, a couple of people have that.
Next stop, Bioware.
there's nothing in that game that is incidental or accidental. Everything purposeful. In that game has meaning. Some of them are just kind of little personal Easter eggs, little shout-outs to friends and whatever. But everything in the game has some sort of meaning, either for myself or for the theme or for the history or whatever it is.
So what's it like dealing with Steam on the southernmost tip of Africa?
So as far as living in South Africa, it's not too bad, actually.
Okay.
I had to just go through a bunch of paperwork, and I actually had to phone the IRS and kind of tell them who I am and what my company is and all that stuff. For me, it was actually the technical aspects that were the most challenging. And I had a friend, Niku from Celestial Games, who had gone through this stuff before, like helped me set up some of the technical stuff.
It's
kind of like user unfriendly. They expect you to be this super high level developer. I'm not that guy. I'm far more of an art focused sort of guy. So my technical skills are not that great. But you know, eventually I kind of just pieced it all together, and you know, it's
that surprises me a lot, because I mean, like, I watch the Jimquisition on repeat. And by the way that he describes it, it seems like the easiest process in the world. And people can literally just flood the platform with junk. But I mean, like, when you say it now, it kind of makes sense to me that, I'm sure there are tons of legal things that you need to fill in.
Yeah.
Jargon on jargon on jargon that need to understand. And you say that that's not the case, which is really surprising. But it makes it, well, no, you say that is the case, which it's not just as easy as, here's the game, upload, done.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you released your game, was it on Greenlight or did it go directly to Steam?
I put it through Greenlight.
Yeah.
I think I launched the campaign in December last year.
Yeah.
And it was greenlit within 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I expected it to take longer. I was keeping a beady eye on the stats and votes and all that stuff. And from what I understood, you had to get into at least the top 50% on Greenlight to even begin to be considered.
Oh, wow.
My game didn't even get that. It didn't even get, I think maybe it got about 1,000 yes votes, maybe about 1,200 or so, and they pushed it through. So I'm pretty sure that Greenlight is still curated to some extent, or was curated, to some extent, you know, because I mean, my game was effectively done.
Yeah.
You know, it just needed some techie stuff and the Steam integration and all that.
Yeah.
So they probably saw that and were like, yeah, cool, this game looks ready to go. Let's just push it through.
Awesome. That's really cool, actually.
And the trailers and the build of it didn't make it look like bollocks.
Exactly.
There's
yeah.
an awful lot. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think if there is any curating, you can see it's like, okay, this is
a real game.
This looks like a real game. This looks like bollocks.
Yeah. This is an asset flip.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah. I don't want to say any names, but you watched the Jimquisition.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
You know who I'm talking about, yeah.
It rhymes with horrible.
No, you don't.
No, it doesn't do anything.
General matricide.
No. Well, you know, but so you said that the second game is kind of half written. I know when you say half written, you mean from a narrative standpoint?
Yeah.
Have you started programming it and putting it together?
No, not yet. No. Okay. At the moment, I'm actually working mostly full time for Celestial Games,
right.
Doing 3D art on their current project, Battle Arena Drones.
Are you allowed to talk about it?
I can talk about what's currently out there.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make sure that you don't inadvertently go, and this is going to be great, this is a great feature, and we have to dump half of a podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, can you give us a brief rundown of what the game is about, or what sort of game it is, just for our listeners who might be interested in picking it up on Women's Day?
Celestial's game or my game?
Your game.
My game, right,
yes.
Yeah.
First-person point-and-click survival horror. No.
No, not a survival horror, nor is it a walking simulator.
Okay.
It's a first-person thriller adventure.
All right.
So it has elements of kind of old-school classic point-and-click adventure games, King's Quest, Monkey Island, that sort of stuff. So there are puzzles to solve, inventory items, all that kind of like classic gameplay, but in a first-person perspective.
That's awesome.
And that's why you say it differs from a walking simulator, because there's more for you to do than just go around the place picking up stuff, looking at it, and getting a backstory before the big reveal at the end.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. There are elements of
skill.
Yeah, there are elements of skill. I mean, there are puzzles in the game that are kind of, you might liken to Myst and that sort of stuff. So some of them...
Are they as rock hard as Myst and Rivenwer?
A couple of them are.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I think I remember playing Riven back in the day, and I had to start keeping a journal, where you're writing down things. Oh, this symbol means an A, and this symbol means a B. And
yeah, you know what? I do expect some players to keep a piece of paper next to them. You know, I mean, that's how I grew up playing games.
Yeah.
That is, you know, I wanted to make a game that I would enjoy.
Yeah.
You know, and... It, as I say, admittedly, I did miss the mark on a couple of design issues there, and I have since kind of retweaked some of the puzzles since it was launched to sort of make them slightly less obscure. And I still have some design and content updates that I'm working on at the moment that as soon as I can find some time, I can actually put together and put out.
Now, when you made this game, were you working full-time, or you just managed to dedicate a lot of your... I mean, because this is the thing, is it like... the way you've described it, making a game is a tremendous amount of work.
Yeah,
it's kind of hard to balance that with a full-time job.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to have funding to keep myself working on Among the Innocent full-time for a year and a half.
Wow.
So I would say about 90, maybe 95% my own work, and then I had a couple of friends come in and contribute some UI graphics. The soundtrack I did with a friend of mine, so it's a unique soundtrack. That's
really impressive. I mean, like, I can't even think of when 5 o'clock rolls around, I'm just so beat.
Yeah.
I don't think I would be able to even code a game, code the homepage of a game.
Yeah.
And you went and did this all on your own. That's really, really impressive.
It was, I mean, it was tough. Like, you know, I went from, you know, I was at NAG magazine for 7 years, and so working in a very sociable, upbeat office environment to basically locking myself away in my home office for a year and a half.
Wow.
You know, it's kind of, the game is kind of telling of that. You know, when you begin in a cabin and you're trapped in the cabin, I was experiencing literal
based
cabin fever.
Based on a true story.
Yeah, I mean, it really is, yeah.
Well, at least as long as you didn't wake up one morning surrounded by bodies and a whole bunch of code that just said, all work and no play makes Jeff a dull boy. All work and no play makes Jeff a dull boy.
Look, I had my days, you know. I'll be honest.
But it is, I mean, I imagine like working on a game like that, well, I mean, obviously every single gamer, every single developer is personally invested in what they do, otherwise they don't bother. But working on a very, very dark game,
yeah,
it's got to take its toll on you.
Yeah.
I remember talking to, what was his name? Jason Graves, if you remember him. He did the soundtrack for the first two, actually did the soundtrack for 3 Dead Space games.
Okay.
And he won a BAFTA for the first one. And he said, by the end of it, I was drained because you're just... That soundtrack just takes you and drains you.
Yeah.
When he won his BAFTA, he said, thank you to my wife who put up with nearly a year of some of the most hideous sounds you've ever heard coming out of the studio. But yeah, I mean, like I said, it's got to take your toll.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And you know what? There's a lot to be said for keeping track of your mental health as an indie game developer. It's a topic that comes up more and more and more these days. And I realized that I should have been more kind of open and more communicative and more sociable even during that development. It would have benefited the game. So going into the next game, that is fully my intention, is to be more open and receptive and not get too stuck inside my own head, because it can be dangerous.
Will you involve more people from the indie gaming scene out here? Because like, from what I've understood, well, what I found since being back here for about 2.5 years, is that the indie game scene here is very tight-knit.
Yeah.
And like, it's kind of like punk rock, and that like, okay, I'll be the lead singer in this band, but you be the drummer in this band, but you can be guitar in that band.
Yeah.
So you have people who come in who are working on their own games, and they'll look at yours and go, okay, if you added this... And I can do that for you if you can help me out like this.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind working like that. And I have some good friends in the industry, not necessarily in the sort of more formal part of the industry like IESA or Make Games SA. I'm not a big kind of like formal communities kind of guy, but I have a number of friends in the industry who I'm very keen on working with.
Okay.
So, one last question. Yeah. How did you start? Where did you start, rather? Because I've had conversations with a couple of people that have been like, oh, I want to make a game.
Yeah.
But I don't know how. They don't know anything about programming. They can tell a good story. But how did you start with the whole technical side of doing it to make your story, bring your story to life?
Yeah, when I began, I had just left NAG, and it was 3 months before Rage that year. Yeah. And so I decided that I would put together a demo of the game for Rage. And that was basically, it's the beginning part of the game where you need to escape the cabin.
Yeah.
And so I sort of went in with the intention to kind of block out the main structure for the game, but within a really kind of small area. And it actually ended up being kind of a nice tutorial area because of that.
Yeah.
So I started learning Unity for Among the Innocent. So I picked it up for the first time to work on that. And I'm not a technical guy. I'm not a programming guy. My background is art and writing.
Oh, this is why I think it's perfect to ask somebody
like
you that question.
Unity has a lot of really, really good assets and plugins for streamlining the actual programming process of a game. And as you say, in the case of asset flips, sometimes those tools are misused. But there are some really solid actual game design tools that I used. Two of them in particular, Adventure Creator and Playmaker.
Okay.
And it allowed me to build the game interactions without having to open up scripts and hand code everything. Yeah. So it's sort of, it's visual programming essentially.
Okay.
So you receive data or a player action or whatever, and then you produce an event based on that, whether it's dialogue or add an item to their inventory or that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
So actually Unity kind of, if you don't know programming or how to script out huge events.
Yeah.
It's really awesome to just pick that up and then learn how to use it from there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is it still free?
Is it free?
Yes.
Yeah. The assets are not. Adventure Creator, I think, is about $70 once off. But before Unity, I did work in a program called Construct2, which is a 2D HTML5-based game dev tool that works in a sort of similar way. There's no real hand coding of stuff, but that did give me a really good understanding of how a game is put together.
Okay.
And the kind of stuff that you need before you even kind of sit down and start doing stuff.
Yeah.
And I just kind of applied that logic and made a lot of mistakes because of it, but I learned.
I mean, you have a game on Steam and we don't. So.
I mean, there's that. Yeah. Like, so at least I did that. Yeah.
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 Okay.
So I think that's going to do it for this edition of the podcast.
Wait, are you getting the Hearthstone expansion pack this week?
No. I don't do crack.
I don't do crack.
When did you buy your crack?
Literally payday.
Actually, we used to stop because we did get people last week going, "Wow, don't you just turn it into the Blizzard show, you guys?"
Yeah, we did. More than one person actually. I had a friend tell me, "You guys need to lay off the Blizzard juice."
Yeah. Anyway,
so, yeah. Thank you so much for joining us, Jeff. Cool. That was really, really awesome. And
well,
nice little bit of insight and learn about your game. Check it out on Steam, Among the Innocent, A Stricken Tale. You can just search Among the Innocent and you'll find it. Mm. I think I have a few spare randellas left after the Steam sale last month.
Ah, you see, I already played it.
Well, I will buy it because I need something to play this weekend coming. Mm-hmm. So I will check it out. Awesome. So from myself, cheerio. From Nick.
Bye-bye.
And from Jeff.
Cheerio.
Cheers, guys. We will see you next week. Bye.
Sorry, the number you have dialed is not in service at this time.